Hey guys, this is the Vertical Guidance Podcast.
I'm Wyatt Fink.
And I'm Alex Danger.
And we're interviewing pilots from around the industry about their flight training experiences. And our goal is to make getting into the aviation industry easier by offering advice to people that are right on the edge of beginning their aviation journey.
So let's get into it. Sit back, relax, and enjoy the ride. Today on the Vertical Guidance Podcast, we have Dan Malott. Welcome on, Dan.
Hey, glad to be here. Thanks for inviting me on. You guys have been doing some cool stuff. Heard a lot about you, and flattered you guys would invite me on. I appreciate it.
Thanks. Thanks for coming on. We like to start out by getting like certain qualifications and a quick history of your aviation career. So if you would go into depth on that, that'd be awesome.
Yeah, you bet. Now, first things first, Alex, I noticed that there's, now I know that your listeners aren't going to be able to hear this, but there's a really cool flag right behind you there that I'm pretty proud of. What is that flag about?
The Sioux flag, baby.
All right. So anyway, it's great talking, and I'm glad that there's some UND people doing this podcast because I certainly support UND, and I just thought I would mention that. How far, like my... I go back. I'm kind of old now. Like, you want me to give you a kind of a longer history of my aviation background?
Sure. It's a pretty cool background. So just dive right into it.
I don't know if it's cool, but all right. Well, I did take notes. And now, again, people can't see it, but you guys can see I prepared for this. So I wrote down a bunch of notes. And so I'll kind of go through some of these things here. And you can cut out half of it because I'll talk too long. But I would say, you know, my interest in aviation started when I was really young. So like a lot of us, I was probably around the age of 5 or 6. And I had kind of two different things that got me like interested in aviation. The first one was a family neighbor in Indiana. So all of my family's from Indiana. And when I was 2, my parents moved to San Diego and then they got divorced when I was about 5 and my mom moved back to Indiana. So I reference Indiana and San Diego, but when my parents' friends, the gentleman had a 1955 Cessna 170B. And so as a very young age, he would take me flying, and there's pictures of me going up in that airplane. And as I got older, you know, as like a teenager, you know, he, got me involved in the EAA club there in Indiana when I was back visiting. I grew up mostly in San Diego with my dad, but so I joined the EAA chapter. I would go to Oshkosh with him. Just, you know, one of those things where we love sharing aviation with kids and getting them involved. And so he did an amazing job. This was before Young Eagles even existed. So really kind of just a cool story. And then the other thing that really got me interested in aviation, in particular the airlines, was, you know, growing up in a divorced household, you know, my dad lived in San Diego and my mom was in Indiana. And so, well, how do you go back and forth? You go back and forth in the airlines. And I was actually at a conference a couple of years ago. And one of the interesting things, it was, you know, very introspective conference. And one of the things that I was able to look back on was the emotional connection that I had to the airlines. And so really, when you look back at it, it makes a lot of sense, right? Like, what did I use to go visit mom or go visit dad? And it was the airlines. I mean, the airlines connected me and my family. And so growing up, you know, not only did I love aviation, but the airlines in particular were a very deep-seated emotional attachment to me. And so from the age of about 6, you go back at like, my dad kept this little book of mine that I wrote, like what I wanted to do when I grew up. And every single thing since I was like 5 or 6 years old was, I want to be an airline pilot. I did not want to be a fireman. I never wanted to be a policeman. I never wanted to be in the military. I didn't want to fly a fighter jet. I wanted to be an airline pilot. And so those two things really sparked my interest as a kid, and nobody else in my family flew. My cousin later got into aviation. Ironically, he's in the UAS field. He did not go to UND, but some of my former students will say, hey, I ran into your cousin, Brian, you know, out in Oregon or whatever. So it's always a small world. So that was how I got into aviation. As I mentioned, I grew up mostly in San Diego. So I got my private pilot's license in 1996, which is hard to believe, but it's 25 years ago. Now I've had my private license, which is pretty cool. I flew out of Montgomery Field there in San Diego. I came to UND in the fall of 1996. And if you want to Google like the worst year in modern history for Grand Forks, North Dakota, that one could be so dumb to leave San Diego and go to Grand Forks. It would have been the fall of 1996 because the spring of 97 was then the absolute horrendous winter. We had so many, well, first of all, the temperatures that year and the wind chills were just stupid. We had stupid amounts of snowfall. And as you guys know, North Dakota is very cold, but we usually don't get a lot of snowfall. But this year they got a ton of snow and it was horrendously cold. And so, you know, of course in Grand Forks, there's no place to go. And then we had all kinds of ice storms and power outages. The dorms were out of power. It was unbelievable. And then, you know, and then in the spring it flooded because there was no place for all this stuff to go. And it was just, I mean, an absolute chaos of a time. But that, you know, whenever I look back in my life and something crazy like that happens, one of the cool things that I got to do was I did a lot of sandbagging, not through UND. I was out at the dikes through friends that, you know, had family or friends in Grand Forks. And so I actually, I had a really bad living situation my freshman year in the dorms. And so this allowed me to actually meet a lot of people in Grand Forks. And so I actually, through the flood, really came to enjoy the people of Grand Forks and get to know people in Grand Forks. It was a very big community effort. And then, of course, the ensuing flood and all that was just, it was kind of an eye-opener for a guy from San Diego. So that was in 1996. I finished school in December of 99. I started working full-time for UND in January of 2000. And I say I finished in 99 because anybody that knows me knows that I was a terrible student. And I had one class that I never finished. And so I had to actually go back to class in spring of 2001 just to finish that one class. I don't even remember what it was, but I graduated formally in May of 01, but I walked in December of 99. So I was pretty much done in December of 99. And I worked for full time for UND after that. Had a lot of great opportunities for promotion. And I still to this day say that was the biggest development opportunity for me in terms of leadership and management was the 2.5 years that I worked for UND. So I was given an opportunity to be a lead instructor and a flight manager. And then I was able to be a check airman. Then I started teaching ground school for UND. I taught my first CFI ground school the spring of 2002. And, you know, we talk about ironic connections. You know, some of the first students I ever had in that class, I still talk to today, one of whom has had a tremendous career in general aviation. His name is Paul Salek, and he's the owner of All In Aviation out in Las Vegas. Just a tremendous career that most people know about him and his path through Cirrus, through Lone Mountain Aviation, and now his partnership in All In Aviation. Just an amazing guy. So really some incredible opportunities that UND gave me. They let me fly the Beech Baron, which it was a little different than what we use the King Airs for today, but it was really an amazing opportunity to fly the King Air. I also got to go to they used to send us to a joint National Guard leadership training program that they would send all the lead instructors to back then. And I really took that to heart. I really learned a ton from that working with some of the military leadership people and, you know, just a civilian participant down in Bismarck. But I just, UND gave me so many opportunities that I was so grateful for. And I realized, you know, UND and education and teaching is kind of what you make of it. And man, UND really gave me a lot of opportunities and I took every advantage of it. In the mid 2002 year though, I really, really still wanted to fly. And so I took the, you know, I applied at a bunch of places. You know, it's different today, but back then I applied everywhere I could. And I was fortunate enough to get hired on with one of, at the time, the best regional to be at was called Atlantic Coast Airlines. If you think you've heard of it, you probably haven't. You've probably heard of like Atlantic Southeast or ASA or something else, but ACA was headquartered in Dulles, Virginia. And we had United bases in Washington Dulles and Chicago O'Hare. And then we had Delta bases in Cincinnati, Ohio. And I believe it was Boston, somewhere in the Northeast. I think it was Boston, but I flew on the United side. We operated CRJs 200s and then the Jetstream 41, which is a turboprop, which actually has propellers on the front. And it's got about 30 passengers and it had a laboratory, which at the time they had just upped from the Jetstream 32s, I think it was, that did not have a lab. They were like the Beech 1900 where there was no flight attendant or a lab. So I at least had a laboratory. We had about 30 passengers. It was a great experience, learned a ton, sat reserve for about a year and a half. And then the story of Atlantic Coast Airlines, if you Google it, they became Independence Airlines. And when I got my third furlough notice, as they were struggling in this problem, United had filed for bankruptcy. So there's a lot of other things in the industry. You guys have probably heard this industry is up and down. So they were trying to become Independence Airlines. And in this whole process, after I got my third furlough notice, they had canceled the previous two. I got a job at, well, it's for the UND Aerospace Foundation. We used to do the training for Cirrus Design out of Duluth, which is now Cirrus Aircraft. And so I reached out to some friends at UND that ran that contract, and I was able to get a job as a factory instructor to be based out of Duluth. So I was all set for my furlough. And then I literally, I had my girlfriend, who's now my wife, flew out to DC. We had packed up my car. I left DC and I got a call from the chief pilot. And he's like, "Hey man, great news. You know, we're going to cancel this furlough." And I was like, "Dude, this is my third furlough, man. Like, I can't do this. I got a job. I gotta work." And he's like, "No problem." He's like, "We'll put you on a leave of absence." So I formally took a leave in like December of 2003, but it was basically a furlough because then they really started going downhill from that. They did end up getting independence started. They flew the CRJs, but they eventually, they burned through $300 million of cash in about a year. They set a record for fastest loss of cash. And then they went bankrupt. Really great company though, ACA. If you talk to the guys that were there, they'll tell you it was a great company, great people, fun management to work with. Nothing to complain about other than the fact that it was a bad time in the industry, you know, and very low pay, very difficult career back then. But the company itself treated us really well at the time. You know, I think I made 18,000 bucks my first full year there at W2. So it was low, but I mean, at the time, like, again, it was cool. So I left there in 2003 to go teach up at Cirrus. I was a factory instructor for Cirrus through the UND Aerospace Foundation from 2003 to 2004. So I was out of Duluth. I was living in Minneapolis. And basically, you know, I would teach customers that would buy a Cirrus. They'd get 3 free days in the aircraft. Really cool experience. I got to go all over the U.S. Doing that. But I was still traveling a ton and I was kind of ready for a change. And so I ended up starting an online master's degree through the University of Phoenix, just an MBA. And I got a couple of random jobs in Minneapolis. One was a Target assistant store manager, which ironically, I wanted just a part-time job, but they interviewed me 5 times and they kept pushing me for a higher job. And so here I ended up working 60 hours a week, basically running the Target store, which I had never planned on. And then I also underwrote car insurance for a while for Country Insurance. And I loved Country Insurance. It was a great family type company, loved the people I worked with, but just wasn't what I wanted to do. It was just to earn income while I was doing my degree. And then in October of 2005, I started meeting with some of the guys up at UND, just saying, "Hey, you know, I'm not sure where life's going to take me, but you know, I love UND and love teaching. And so I'm not sure where this could go." And at the time they were just building their Tokai program and their relationships with the JCAB over in Japan there. And so my former boss, Dick Schultz, was like, "You know, maybe, you know, we could use your help for this new program." So I came back to UND at Flight Ops back in 2005, originally with the intent to, you know, primarily help with that. And of course, do all the other lead instructor stuff. So I got all my Japanese POS certificates. I was one of the first 5 that went over there and it was a really cool experience. Got to do, you know, meet really amazing people and I wouldn't have traded that for the world. And ended up being a designated examiner for the country of Japan for 2 full years of doing a check rides, which was awesome. And then in 2006, I finished my master's degree and the opportunity to move on campus was there. So I was fortunate enough to be hired as an assistant professor at UND in 2006. And the rest for UND is kind of history. I remained there as a full-time professor, got tenure like in 2010 or 11. Love teaching, love UND. And the great thing that I love about UND is they encourage us or they support us doing things in the industry. You know, you've probably seen this, like a lot of your faculty members aren't just people that came up through academia, right? Like they've come from some part of the industry, they've worked in the industry, or they still have consulting businesses in the industry. And that's what makes UND, I think, very, very special is that our aviation department is still very engaged, kind of like the med school. The med school has doctors come in and teach, like they'll come from surgeries and then they'll teach in the classroom. And so I think it gives students, you know, more value because your professors are actually working in the industry. So so some of the things that I've gotten to do while I've been a professor at UND, you know, most people know I was a co-founder of Valley MedFlight. We started that in 2010, and then we exited that business in 2013. And that was pretty exciting. You know, we grew that company from nothing up to operating 6 Pilatus BC-12s. We had 4 bases, 40 some full-time employees. It was a really great, amazing experience. And I was very grateful to be able to help start that and then exit that company. In 2016, I wanted to get back into the CIRRUS stuff. So I got my CIRRUS standardized instructor certificate. So it's called a CSIP. You basically operate independently, but under the CIRRUS factory, you know, basically authorization. So I do some CIRRUS instruction under, we created an LLC called Valley In-Flight Training. That's just an LLC that Shane Dacu actually and I do our own training through. It's very limited. In 2017, I was able to get a Citation CJ type rating. The university gave us some development money for professors to try to stay actively engaged in the industry. So I was fortunate enough to be able to go down to Wichita and get a type rating. And then I've used that type rating to go fly with some friends that fly in the industry. So I was able to get about 80 hours of flight time just here and there, some random trips flying in the business jets. I was a co-founder of Valley Aircraft Services, which is a small service company up in Manville. We used to operate, you know, flight training and rental up there. And my neighbor, ironically, up in Manville runs the maintenance side of that. It was a pretty small operation I exited that a few years ago, and my neighbor still runs the maintenance facility up there. A shameless plug for him. If you have any maintenance needs, it's a great service. It's close to Grand Forks, so I highly recommend you bring your airplanes up to Manville for service. And then the last thing I'll mention is I mainly fly like in GA side. I fly our family Cessna 414. It's a twin Cessna aircraft. That's probably what I have the most experience in now. It was the original airplane that we started Valley Medflight with. And so we had switched to Pilatus's. And so when we sold the company, the new owner was kind of like, why do I have this old beat up twin Cessna parked in a hangar? And so I bought the airplane back from the new owner. We had to put a new engine on it. And, you know, it's an old airplane, kind of beat up, but I have four kids and I'm married. So it's a good family airplane for us. And then the last thing I'll mention outside of like GA type stuff, most people know, but last November, I was fortunate enough to be hired at Sun Country Airlines as a first officer on the Boeing 737NG aircraft. We're based out of Minneapolis. Most people that are listening to this probably know what Sun Country Airlines is, but outside of the upper Midwest, nobody knows what it is. My mom forever thought that I flew for Suncoast Airlines, and nobody even knows what it really is, but it's a pretty cool opportunity that I've gotten to do and get back into flying. So I know that was way too long, but that's kind of all the stuff that I have done in aviation for 25 years.
Yeah, that's a crazy story, Dan. So I just have a question. Since you went to the regionals, like pretty much really shortly after college, and then we had that downturn in the industry. If we didn't have a downturn, would you have ideally move to a legacy and that's where you'd be today?
Yeah, that's a great, great question, Wyatt. So one of the things that, and this is, again, you've probably heard this from old people like me or your parents or, you know, other people that you at least look up to, if you look up to your parents, you know, hopefully you do. But, you know, when you talk to old people that have been around the block a few times, I'm a big believer in, number one, everything happens for a reason. And number two, you know, opportunities come out of problems. And so, you know, when I look back to that question, would I have gone to a legacy? Probably. I probably would have gone on to, you know, the logical flow from ACA probably would have been United, because we flew United Express or Delta. When I was in college, I kind of thought a cool opportunity would be to fly for Northwest and live in St. Paul. I thought that would be cool. Growing up in San Diego and me being kind of a goofball, I kind of thought Southwest Airlines would kind of be cool. So, you know, yeah, I had all these ambitions to just go on to a major. But when I got there, you know, and very quickly after United filed for bankruptcy, I started recognizing that it was going to be a lot, let's just say, crappier than I had anticipated. My dad still kept the text message that I sent him, which would have been now 18 years ago. And it just said, not sure this is what I want to do long-term, which is interesting, right? Because I was at the airlines, I had made the dream, but there was all these things happening. You know, I was placed in the turboprop. It was interesting. They would start the turboprop guys on Friday afternoon. You wouldn't do anything. You would just show up and then you would formally start on Friday afternoon. they would start the jet guys Monday morning. Now you made the same amount of money and, you know, whatever, but they started you Friday afternoon because even though you got stuck in the turboprop, you had a higher seniority number than the guys that started on Monday morning. So they're like, hey, if you're stuck in the turboprop, whatever. And then they said, okay, after a year, you can move to the jet or you can stay in the turboprop and get the jet pay. And so I was like, okay, that's kind of cool. Well, here's what happened. In the contract, it said, you can get jet pay if you stay in the turboprop if there's an opening in the jet. Well, after a year, when the industry was moving backwards, there were no openings in the jet. So the jet guys went from like $23 an hour to like $35 an hour. Now, I know it sounds stupid. So that's like going from $22,000-$23,000 a year to $35,000 a year. But the jet guys went from like $22,000 a year to $23,000 a year, or the turboprop guys. So we got this, like, they hadn't put it in the contract to make any more money. And then here's the kicker, was then we owed union dues after our first year. So now I actually took a pay cut my second year. So now I'm like, I can't get out of the turboprop. I'm taking a pay cut my second year. And so that's what happens when the industry kind of starts to move backwards. So my scenario, when I look back at it, you know, I'm like, okay, I probably made the right decision to get out at that point. You know, it was a really hard decision to make, but I think I made the right call. And then I look at the things that I've done in the past 15 years, you know, so good into my other point of like, okay, everything happens for a reason. And then making opportunities or taking opportunities that present themselves to you, you know, like Valley MedFlight, for example, I love telling the story how I got a random call from a nurse that worked at All True, and he got my number from somebody at UND. He called me out of the blue and was just like, hey, I got your number from so-and-so. I don't know if you have a few minutes to talk, but I've got this idea. And he ended up being the president. He ran basically everything. I mean, tremendous, tremendous success record from there. But like the random opportunities that came my way because I was in Grand Forks. And so, yeah, like it's kind of these weird things. Why, to kind of summarize your question, like, would I have been at a major? Probably. That's probably the trajectory I would have gone on. But would I trade the past 15 plus years for anything? And then the answer would be no. Like, I would never trade the experiences that I've gotten to do since then for anything. So that's a great question. Hopefully I answered that in too long of an answer.
It seems like you've been in quite a bit of business side of aviation. Would you go a little bit in depth on like the MBAA and the business side of aviation?
Yeah. So you guys mentioned the business side of aviation, and I get asked that a lot, and it's very common, but I want to make sure that we differentiate between two things that people ask questions on. So the business side of aviation can refer to what people are thinking when they hear that. They're thinking either A, non-flying positions. That's the business side, right? Running the company, or business aviation, meaning corporate aviation, jobs in business aviation. So those are two sort of separate things. So when you mention NBAA, the National Business Aviation Association, which you guys have probably had me in class and you've heard me talk about that. So their primary support or purpose is to support the use of business aircraft for companies. So for example, you know, we have a couple of companies in Grand Forks that operate business aircraft and they're members of NBAA. So when you talk about NBAA and you talk about business aviation, there's a lot of opportunities to fly for corporate operators, flying business aircraft, business aviation. That's the Gulf Streams. But as I talk about in my GA ops classes, business aviation is way more than, I always joke, the fat rich guy. That's what everybody thinks. It's the fat rich guy going to golf in like Florida. Now, while there's a few of those people that's what happens in corporate aviation, a majority of business aviation is actually small and mid-sized companies flying, you know, Cirruses, flying Piper Malibus, flying TBMs, Pilatuses, King Airs, Citations, Learjets, Falcons, Hawkers. There's thousands and thousands of business aircraft that operate all over the country, well, the world, but the United States by far is the leader of that. And so for the airline jobs that are out there, there's also all these corporate aircraft flight jobs. So when you mention NBAA, that's sort of the support or what they're talking about. Now, if you're talking about the business side of aviation, meaning running the company, I often talk to people about what are opportunities to work in aviation outside the cockpit. And that's a whole other discussion because, you know, for like Valley MedFlight, when we started that company, okay, we have pilots, but for pilots that we also have paramedics and nurses. That's the flight crew. And then outside the flight crew, right? We have to have people that manage the bookkeeping. So you have accountants, you have just general business people, you have a president, you have people that are in sales or marketing. So you have all of these other things and other jobs in aviation, even at the airlines, right? At the airlines, you know, you have flight crews, but you also have ground-based crews. You have people that work in marketing. You have people that work in revenue management. You have people that work in operations. You have people that work in finance. So those are kind of two separate things, right? There's the business side of aviation, and then there's actually flying in business aviation.
Okay, that makes sense.
Sorry, Tango, I cut you off.
No, you're good.
So if somebody wanted to kind of slide into an outside of the cockpit business side of aviation type of job, it sounds like you've done a fantastic job of doing that and diversifying yourself, but how would someone do that if they don't have the connections, I guess you could say?
Sure. Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I could probably give too many examples, but you know, first of all, when you say without too many connections, my brain immediately says, well, then go get them. Like, that's just that was my instantaneous response when you say, I don't have connections. And my response is, well, go get them. And I also have a whole presentation on networking. And there's never been an easier time to network than today, because, you know, you can go on LinkedIn and you can find a company, you can sort it by where they went to school. So I can find all the UND alum there. And so as a student, holy cow, I would say, hi, Mr. Smith. You know, my name is Alex. I'm a junior or senior at the University of North Dakota. I see you work for NetJets, you know, as an operations manager. I'm looking at opportunities outside of the cockpit. And I was wondering if you'd be willing to visit with me a little bit about, you know, your path in aviation. And I can tell you what, as I mentioned a long time ago here in the interview, but people love to share their experiences. You know, they love to talk to younger people. And so if you just ask them to visit with them about their experience in aviation, they're going to love it. And they're going to absolutely talk to you. And if you schedule a phone call with them, that's great. And I always tell people, set a goal, set one new phone call every single week, maybe make 10 connections on LinkedIn, but actually schedule a phone call once a week with a new connection, and then just stay in touch with those people and make each one of those connections in a different bucket, like corporate aviation and the airlines and a legacy airline and a regional airline and a firefighter, a pipeline patrol person, somebody that flies in Alaska, because it's a small world. And so we all talk, we all know each other. And so, you know, if you don't have the connections, my immediate response is always go get the connection. So that would be my first thing. Then I would also talk about one of the things that I share with people that say, man, I'm really thinking about getting a second major or a minor. And in fact, I have a call right after this with a family who's very concerned about that. They're concerned that their son won't be able to get the commercial aviation degree. So they're like, well, what should we do as a backup plan if they can't go into flying? And I get this all the time. My experience is this. If you want to get a minor or a second major because you have a passion in that field, great. If you have like a lot of guys are like, man, I love the outdoors. I've always wanted to do like DNR work, you know, like fly for the DNR. I'm like, that's awesome. Then get a biology major or a minor. You know, like if you have that passion, then by all means do that. Or if you want to get into like law enforcement aviation or fly for the DOD or something like that, then by all means, maybe criminal justice or something like that as a second major. But if you don't necessarily have a direct passion for that, I can tell you that over the years, I have known so many guys either voluntarily or involuntarily have left the cockpit for so many reasons, right? Some of them are medically disqualified. Some of them have an arrest record that they can't overcome. Some people just for family reasons, they don't want to fly. So for so many reasons, I have all these friends that have gotten out of the cockpit over the years, and they've done all kinds of random stuff, and they don't have any, you know, degrees in it. And here's what I've learned, and I've actually been able to reflect on after, you know, being in the industry and having friends for so long. And that is, as a pilot, so this is mostly for the pilots that are listening right now, but as a pilot, or, and I shouldn't just say pilot, anybody who's in operations in aviation, so air traffic controllers are going to be in the same boat here, okay? If I'm flying along in an aircraft, okay, and I have like an engine failure, I have to be able to do a lot of things in a very short period of time. I have to be able to deal with an emergency situation. I have to be able to make decisions. How often do we talk about aeronautical decision-making in college there? I can assure you at an airline, on a daily basis, you are making decisions. And I go to I go to so many committees, like, you know, nonprofits or church things or, you know, whatever. And everybody has a hard time making a decision. They want to please everyone. They want to get all this input. And that's just not the way a pilot's brain is wired. You know, we're kind of wired to be like, give us the information. Let's do teamwork if we can. Sometimes you don't have time. And if your engine's on fire, you got to pull the red handle. But like, if there's an emergency, like there's bad weather or, you know, you got to divert. I mean, give me the input and then we're going to make a decision. And we talk about this in ADM, right? We're just going to make the decision. It may not be the perfect option, but it's a safe option, right? And then at the end of that decision, right, we have to execute the decision. Then at the end of that decision, we actually reflect and we evaluate that decision, right? That's the last step typically in the ADM model, is to evaluate, did I do the right thing or not? And so I can tell you, man, a pilot every day, you are talking to flight attendants, ground crews, dispatch, SOC, maintenance, you know, like it's just incredible the amount of teamwork, coordination, and decision-making that goes into every flight. A trip I did probably 2 weeks ago, I was flying with a guy and he was put on this trip on reserve, and we had to go to Honolulu. It was an overnight over there. It was really cool. So you're going to go fly 6 hours over the ocean and then 6 hours back with 180 people in the back. And we had two gate returns for mechanical problems. One of them was an aborted takeoff that I had to do. We actually never got up to like takeoff thrust. It was just like, we brought it up. There was a light. We had to bring it back. So now you've got to coordinate with our maintenance, our systems ops control. You got to get a gate. You got to tell the flight attendants. You got to tell the passengers what's going on. You've got just a tremendous amount of stuff before you go flying over the ocean for 6 hours. And I was so happy I got to fly with that captain, because he was so level-headed and just, he kept calm. And I could tell immediately, like you could see him get frustrated for about 2 seconds. He was like really upset. And then he snapped. And he's like, okay. He's like, why don't you call ATC right now? Tell him what's going on. If you don't mind, call the passengers, make a brief announcements, call the flight attendants. I'm going to call systems ops. I'm going to call maintenance. And we're sitting there on this taxiway. I mean, we just got stuff going on like crazy, running the QRH, running the checklist. And I was like, man, this guy is phenomenal. Like his ability to lead, his ability to handle, you know, a lot of pressure, manage all these different teams. So what I get at there is, an hour later, we were flying out over to Honolulu. He did an amazing job, got maintenance, clarified everything, talked to the passengers. Everything was great. He did an amazing job. And you look at like business leaders, and that's what they want. They want people that can do that. And there's an old saying, when you hire people, you hire the right person and you train them for the job. You hire the right person and you train them for the job. So if I can hire somebody who has that skill set to make decisions, be courteous, involve the team, you know, handle emergencies, stay calm, lead by example, you know, all these things that like particularly captains do, it really gives you the skill set to work outside the cockpit. And I literally mean just about any industry. Now, yes, I can't go be a surgeon. You know, I don't have that technical knowledge. But if it's like, you know, really any other job that you can learn the skill and then practice the job, they can hire you and then train you for that job. So yeah, I really think that the skill sets we get in aviation, and that's also air traffic controllers, right? They're presented with a lot of very high pressure situations that they have to very quickly and very effectively deal with. And those types of things help them in their communities. It helps them be leaders, you know, for like their churches. It helps them to be leaders for nonprofits, for just their, you know, their anything they're involved in, or a business that is outside the cockpit or outside the tower cab for controllers.
Okay, cool. Yeah. So going back, just we always talked about it in class, the utilizing the UND mafia to make connections.
Exactly.
So, I mean, I think like we try to do a pretty good job of that with our podcast. It's crazy. Like just sending a basic email to someone, like everyone's just totally willing to help us out, which is awesome. And I think anyone can do it. And then on the second point you had is that like pilots are very marketable in pretty much almost any job industry, which was, I think that's very true as well.
For sure. Yeah. The UND connections are extraordinarily tight. And one of the things that I tell people is, you know, I think, UND, like in particular, it's got a long reputation of what I would call humble confidence. And I talk about that in interview prep and all that stuff, but I think a lot of people that come out of UND are more known for like having sort of a humble approach to their job, being grateful for the opportunities. And that stems from many, many years of UND not necessarily being known as a school. You know, people didn't know about us. And so we had to work extra hard, and it really paved the way for young people. And it's so cold and it's so miserable flying up in Grand Forks that, you know, I always joke, it's kind of like a survivor group. Like I survived 4 years or 5 years in Grand Forks. So we are very tight. And one of the things that I've noticed recently being back out in the industry is just remember that when, and I recognize that this is mostly, you know, hopefully UND guys that are listening to this, but if you're a UND alum and you're going out there, remember that you represent everybody behind you and everybody in front of you. And I've flown with a couple of captains recently that have given me a couple of examples of UND former students, alumni, that unfortunately did not have a great attitude. They were very arrogant and very much like, this is my right to be here. And that is not how UND alum have ever been, but it's right now the industry is so hot that there's always a few people that are like, you know, I can go anywhere I want. And I just spent 150 grand. So this is my right to be here. And so when you're coming to a guy like me, or you're flying with a guy like me, who literally, like when we went to school, we had no idea if we could even get a regional airline job, you know, making 20 grand a year, we would have to fight and just kill for that type of a job. And then you have people who are just like, well, this is my right to be here and blah, blah, blah. It really rubs people the wrong way. If you don't want to be here, don't be here, go somewhere else, go fly at other, you know, regional airline X. So I always encourage people to keep that in mind. Like UND, the reason we're so tight, the reason that they're willing to do anything for you is because of that humble attitude that they had to have when they were in your shoes. They busted their ass for years and years and years to get where they are, and they want to help you get there. And so I just encourage people to reach out, use the UND network. And then when you do get out in the industry, remember that humble attitude, that grateful, you know, be grateful for the opportunities that you get to go fly, you get to go do all kinds of cool things. We get to get paid to go do what we do. And it's really an amazing opportunity. And so just keep that up. But that's why the UND network is so tight, because man, it was so hard back in the day. People didn't know UND. And so for guys like me, that I just have this ingrained thing that I want to help students get to where I am, because I know how hard it was. And I know right now it's not that hard, but that's how the alum feel, is we want to help you guys get out.
Yeah. I agree with that whole thing about like, it could probably be a little annoying for some of those pilots that went through like 01, 08. And then you have these kids who are like, I deserve to be here, 'cause I went through 4 years of UND. But going back on another point you had about, people with just commercial aviation degrees. So I personally just have my commercial aviation degree. Let's say there was an unfortunate event and I lost a medical. Would I be able to apply for like jobs like selling aircraft, aircraft brokers, other things like that without having a background in it or having like a certain degree that specializes towards that?
Yeah. Great question, Alex. So aircraft sales, because you mentioned sales, is a really unique niche market. And the irony about aircraft sales is there is no path to aircraft sales. I mean, they come from like all walks of life, man. I mean, it's true. Like you get some guys that are like, they flew, they were CFIs. They're really good at like demoing airplanes in flight. And so maybe they might sell like piston aircraft. You get some guys that just have done big sales their entire careers, and they want to sell airplanes. They don't even fly. They've never flown. You know, they're not a pilot, but they're really good at sitting in the back of like a Gulfstream and doing like, you know, doing air, you know, actual sales or financial pieces of sales or talking, you know, accounting and depreciation and that type of stuff. And then you have everything in between. So aircraft sales is a very unique opportunity. And the UND alum that I know that there's probably three either sales companies or divisions of sales companies in the cities, the Twin Cities, that are pretty large. I mean, there's a number of smaller ones, but what I would say pretty large companies in the cities, and they have UND alum there. They all have entry level positions that come from all walks of life. So yeah, to answer your question, you could apply for any of those jobs. Now, I will say that if it's not in sales, or if it's not in like an area that you feel like you've got a connection, like a UND connection, then it requires reaching out. It requires, you know, don't just apply for the job online. Find the contact for that job and email them and say, hey, you know, I'm interested in someday learning more about, like, here's another example, insurance. Okay. We have three or maybe four UND alum that work at Wings Insurance now out of the Twin Cities. And I know two of those guys reached out to me when they were in the application process there and they needed an introduction, you know, to meet them. Both of the most two recent guys, they're UND alum that joined Wings, were pilots, airline pilots. And for, again, one reason or another, they had an interest in shifting careers and now they're in aircraft insurance. So again, to your point, like, you know, can I do other things? Absolutely. I mean, insurance, sales. I mean, there's for every airline job, there's probably 25 other jobs that are out there that have nothing to do with flying that again, if you're going to sell aviation insurance, that's going to require technical knowledge, but you don't have to go get the technical knowledge first. Generally, they'll hire you as like a mentee, right? Like you start kind of like an apprenticeship almost, right? You get paired with somebody, you learn on the job, you get handed probably insurance books because you're going to have to learn the laws, but you start building relationships. And then, you know, after however much time, then you probably start to get your own book of business where you're actually, you know, working with your own clients and selling your own insurance. But there again, like you can start without the technical training or the certification. Most people know that I took a year of leave of absence in 2018, I want to say. I think it was a year, 2018 to 2019. And I worked for my dad's company. It's a long story. But I was an investment banker and people think like, oh, that's because you had an MBA. I'm like, not really. Really what we are is sales. We basically represent companies that are buying or selling and you're trying to market companies do fundraising for a new startup. And I had to get two securities licenses for that from FINRA, which is a division of the SEC. So I'm actually a licensed investment banker, which is kind of stupid. That's not like your Edward Jones thing. That's like your, like we have the same certifications that like the Wall Street people have that like actually like sell publicly traded companies. So I did that for a year and I mean, I just busted my ass. Like there was one or two other guys that they couldn't pass those tests and they were in the industry, but they couldn't pass the test. It was hard. So I bought a book. I knew I wasn't going to pass it. So I bought a $600 online course. I went through the entire course. I studied my ass off and I passed with like a 92 or 93%. Nice. That was my investment banker license. And then I had to get a state securities license, which is a series 63. And then, that was a lot easier, but man, it was hard. I mean, it took me months of work. And at the same time, I had to get my own book of business. I had to find my own clients. My dad assigned one client to me that I marketed for a sale. I didn't know anything about it. You know, I had to learn it all on the job. I had to study my butt off. I had to work my butt off. It was cold calling thousands of people. It was the most, you know, horrendously awkward stuff I've ever done in my life. But once again, I wouldn't have traded it for the world.
That's pretty neat. So I know coming into UND, I thought that it was all just like airline jobs, all that. And then you were kind of saying how like for every airline job, there's tens of more business jobs. You want to kind of go in about how big like aviation for business side is? Like,
yeah, that side. Yeah, you got it. So let's take, let's take Delta Airlines. Okay. So Delta Airlines, I don't know what their pilot roster is. I should look this up. But if you take Delta Airlines, you know, they may have 15,000 pilots. But for the 15,000 pilots, again, I don't know the number. I should look the number up, but I'm going to assume there's 100,000 plus people that work in the Delta family, right? There's for every pilot. So let's take one Delta flight. Okay. One Delta flight has two pilots on it. If it's a 737, like we fly, there's four flight attendants. If it's a 737, like we fly, right, there's a total of six people generally on board the aircraft. A lot of times we take, if we're doing like a charter flight, we'll take a mechanic with us and a charter rep on that aircraft. So now we have six people on board the aircraft that work for the airline, and only two of them are pilots. So we have mechanics, we have ground handlers, we have station managers, we have station personnel, like the people that work the gate agent. We have systems operations control, and that's kind of like the nucleus of the flight operation. So they're tracking where are our aircraft, where are our people, where is maintenance, where is, you know, they're kind of monitoring the moment to moment thing. It's generally called SOC. You have dispatchers, and the dispatcher and the PIC. It's different than Part 91, like at UND. Part 91, the pilot of command is the final authority. Now that doesn't necessarily go away in Part 121, but the dispatcher has joint responsibility with the PIC. So dispatchers have a huge role in airlines. So you have direct access to a dispatcher anywhere you fly in the world. So dispatching is kind of a cool opportunity. You have crew scheduling, although in fairness, most pilots, no matter which airline you go to, always dislike crew scheduling. So I would caution you if you're going to go work for crew scheduling, but it's a necessary evil of any airline that you go to. So you have scheduling. You have the guys that market the whole company, right? Like you got to market, you got to make sure that you get business. You have revenue generation, you know, whether it's online, social media, whether it's what's called yield management, where you're actually doing the number crunching on what do you charge for fares and how do you price those things out? You need people for that. You need reservations agents. You need customer service personnel. You need ticket counter personnel. I mean, like when you start to think about all of those people and there's two pilots, like that's it, you know? So it's actually shocking the insanely higher number of other jobs that are out there versus just the pilots. The pilots are really, I mean, we're the smallest piece of the puzzle, even though like we get to walk around in uniform and people are like, oh, you know, don't crash today. You know, like they think we do all these great things, but it took the whole team, right? It took the whole team from selling the tickets, planning it out, the security, making sure that everybody is safe, our mechanics, making sure that our airplanes are maintained well and safe to fly, the dispatchers checking our weather and following our flight plans, the gate agents, you know, getting everybody to board, our flight attendants, making sure the airplane is safe and boarding people. Like the team that it actually takes to get the people onto the plane so we can even do our job is staggering. So yeah, like people are like, oh, I'm worried about losing my medical. And I'm like, I understand, like that would suck. And you know, I don't want to ever minimize that. But when people are like, I better get another degree, I'm like, you don't, if you have a passion in another discipline, maybe. You know, like if you need the technical knowledge, if you need a ton of technical knowledge, maybe. But even then, like I said, for investment banking, I needed a ton of technical knowledge, but I went and got it. I went and got the technical knowledge that I needed. And today, more than ever, you can kind of get that anywhere for anything, right? If you need a crash course in accounting or something, you can get that. Unless you want to be a CPA, you know, if you want to be a CPA, you got to have a degree, you got to have like a test and all that stuff. But that's kind of my point is for every job that's a pilot, man, there are a lot of other jobs that are not a pilot.
Yeah, that was, so I totally agree. This is totally an off the wall question, but your resume has got to be like a mile long. It's super impressive. And you've done so many different types of work throughout your life, but where do you get your motivation and drive just to keep going and like be hyper successful individual? Like it's just kind of a question about life, but I was just wondering that as I was listening to this.
Yeah. So that's a good question. And I like off the wall questions. And it's funny. I always tell people, I say, listen, if you got a question for me and you want a quick answer, if you send me like a yes or no question for class, I go, you know, I'm a phone junkie. I'll reply in 2 seconds. No problem. But I say, if you email me and you ask me what is the meaning of life, Dan, I'm like, you know, I'm going to give you a long answer, but you're gonna have to wait until I can sit down in front of my computer and type away. So you asked a couple of questions. So first thing was like the resume. I read something a while back. It was trying to identify what makes somebody an expert in something. Like what qualifies you as like an expert? And I think they were like using an example of like a violinist, you know, like how long would you have to play the violin to be an expert violin player? And I don't remember the research, but it was somewhere like 10,000 hours doing a task or doing something for around 10,000 hours. They found that like the people who were great at what they did, they had done it for around 10,000 hours. Now, to put that in perspective, a full-time job is typically, we estimate it at 2,000 hours a year. Because if you figure 2 weeks vacation, 50 work weeks a year, 40-hour work week, it's 2,000 hours a year. So if you work full-time at one task or one job for 5 straight years, you are like, you're an expert at it. You're really, really good at it. Not guaranteed, but you're probably really good at it. So for example, if somebody's been at like Delta flying the A320 for 5 years on that airplane, they will probably be like a phenomenal A320 pilot at Delta. They'll be amazing. They'll be, you know, you'll get on some of these captains that have flown the same airplane for 5 years. You get on and you're like, man, how does this person know this airplane so good? Why are their landings always so good? It's because they've done it for 10,000 hours in that airplane. So where I'm getting with that is, ironically, I look at my resume and I'm like, that sucks. You know, I look at my resume and I'm like, man, it looks awful, because I approach, so my brain is going in two different directions here. Okay. I look at my resume. I don't have something that I do for 10,000 hours. There's only two things in my life that I look at and I feel like I'm an expert at. There's only two things that I look at and feel like I'm an expert at. The first one is, I feel like I'm really good at the way that I teach classes, because I've done it for a long time. I try to get better. You know, love him or hate him, I went to 2 Tony Robbins conventions a few years ago. And that guy, I had thought that I had a lot of energy until I went to his thing. And I was like, oh my God, I've got to step it up a notch. And so that literally was like, I started using music at the start of my class to try to get everybody's like energy level up. So A, I can teach better, and B, people can learn more. So I try to always improve the energy level that I approach classes with. And I've done that for now, you know, 15 plus years. So again, I've done that long enough where I feel good about doing it. I feel comfortable. I know some students are always going to hate class because we just don't jive. You know, we don't have the right mix. So there's always gonna be students that hate me, but generally speaking, I feel like I do a pretty good job at teaching what I teach. The second thing that I feel really good about, because again, I study it, I do it all the time, is helping other people achieve their goals and dreams. So, you know, for example, like Valley MedFlight, that was not my idea. That was not my like big, that wasn't my big deal. I was able to help this person build this company into what it was, and then we exited. But I was able to help him build this company. I'm able to help students achieve whatever their goals and dreams are. I'm able to help people get their careers. This past year, more than ever, I think every other day I had a phone call with somebody trying to start a company or grow their company. And I'm really good at that. Like, I'm really good at helping them achieve their goals, build their businesses, grow, market, get more customers, because that's all I do. The audiobook I'm listening to right now is called Be Obsessed or Be Average by Grant Cardone. He's a big sales guy. I read books on sales. I read books on personal development. I'm always working on trying to learn new development ways and helping people. Career books, like how do you interview? I always am doing that. So I've done that now for, again, 15 plus years. So I feel really good about that. So to step back, when I look at my resume, you know, Cirrus, man, there are a million guys that are better than me as a Cirrus instructor. Now, I have a couple clients that I work with who, like, our personalities are good. They're UND people. So, you know, I might work with them, but I'm not a Cirrus expert. I mean, I'm like a very maybe average Cirrus guy. I've flown the 737 now for about 500 hours. I still feel like a moron, you know, like that airplane is like, I mean, it's a very humbling airplane. Talk to people that land at the 737. It's a very humbling airplane. And so, I mean, I'm a moron. And people can be like, oh, wow, you know, you're an airline pilot. I'm like, yeah, I don't mean unsafe, but you know, I mean, I'm learning. I'm still like so low. I look at all these things here on what I've done. And I do a lot of these things. Here's why I do all these things. Because for me, it's like some guys want to go surfing in Hawaii. You know, some guys want to go backpack Europe for a month. For me, I'm like, I want to go get a type rating and a citation and go fly for a couple of years in a citation. Like it's that sort of thing. All these like little things along the way, they're things that I love experiencing things in aviation. I'm not good at them, but I enjoy learning about them and experiencing those things. So I look at my resume and I'm like, man, there's a lot of crap on there. Like, it's just kind of like, you know, I was here for 2 years. I did this for 2 years. I did that for 2 years. I did this for 2 years. That, by the way, does not look good on a resume because it looks like I'm, you know, not willing to commit or stay with something. But what I tell people is I go, listen, through all of that though, what I've been doing in my day job has been a UND professor. You know, that's what I did for a long, long time. I'm still, you know, considered a contracted, you know, part-time instructor for UND. So that's what I do long-term. But yeah, my resume, like I've done a lot, but I'm not an expert in any of the stuff that I've done. That's for me, you know, that's kind of like, it's just kind of my personal thing. Like I like to go fly. I like to learn new airplanes. I like to experience new things in aviation. So a lot of that stuff that I've gotten to do is really, I mean, I hate to say it, but it's kind of selfish. You know, it's what I've wanted to do for me.
So going back, you're talking about helping people out. How would you recommend people listening to this podcast or for us to help others to feel that motivation?
You know, I wrote notes down here, you know, so two things. I'm just going to write this down because I'm going to forget. To come back to why it's common about like, how do I stay motivated? Motivation is a really interesting thing. And ironically, a lot of the things that I read are about motivation. And there's an insane science and art to motivation. But for me, it's kind of a daily effort. Like it's literally a daily effort to get pumped up. I use music, you know, a lot of times music will like fire off something, for example, and I learned this again, you know, you can make fun of it all you want, but like a Tony Robbins, you know, imagine that you're at like an NFL game. If you ever gone to an NFL game, when they're doing the lineups, right, there's the starting lineup and they've got the big show, right? You get the big flow of adrenaline. And what's happening is there is sounds and sights that trigger an emotional state. And you can believe it or not, but everybody knows it's true, man. You go to like a big game, like a, you know, a Fighting Hawks or a Fighting Sioux hockey game, you know, and there's this start where the energy just goes through the roof. And what I learned is that you can actually manipulate your own mind to feel that energy at any time by anchoring those triggers that spark off that energy. So if there's a song, like a starting lineup song, and you play that song and you imagine that you're there, you can actually give yourself the same goosebumps that you were if you were there. So I tell people, man, when you're driving to the airport to go flight instruct, listen to a song that you know fires off something inside you that just amps up your energy. So when I go teach a class, by the way, and people are like, what's this music? That music that I play at the start of class, every one of those songs is on my Date with Destiny or Unleash the Power Within playlist that Tony Robbins plays, because my brain instantly is like fired up. I'm like, this is going to be great. Like, this is awesome. I can't believe I'm here. I can't believe I get to do this. And that's what my brain thinks about. And it just fires off all these, you know, emotions inside of you about good vibes, high energy, high motivation. So I encourage people, and it doesn't have to be music, by the way, you know, sometimes you talk to a friend who maybe it's like, for me, like an old college roommate. And so it brings back college memories of fun and goofiness. And so, you know, like there's that type of stuff, but that's how I stay motivated. I use every tool that I can to be at the highest state that I can when I have to. And then, yeah, I take a nap then when I'm tired. Cause I, you know, I finish class and I'm like, oh my God, I'm exhausted. So, you know, sometimes you got to come down a little bit, but yeah, you know, like you go to the gym, you're not going to go to the gym and listen to Enya, right? You're not going to go to the gym and listen to like, right. You're going to like for now, like when I lift weights, man, it's Metallica. It's like, I mean, I listen to like pretty heavy rock or something because that's what I want. And so again, I can listen to that music and I can increase my motivation. Okay, so then coming back to Alex, what did you were mentioning motivation, but you were talking about like how to help other people. So like helping other people, as you guys get older and you move into the workforce, it's so critical that you remember, like, remember the emotions, the feelings, the position that you're in right now. And what I mean by that is, it's hard when you're a junior in college to feel confident going up and talking to a Delta captain, right? Like a Delta or United, like let's say United Aviate comes up or FedEx comes up, you know, for their pathway programs. If there's a FedEx captain that's standing there, you feel intimidated coming up and walking up and introducing yourself. You're kind of nervous. You kind of feel awkward about it. So I would say, remember that position when you're standing there. So like just going up to students and saying, hey, you know, I'm Dan Milan. I'm a captain at, you know, FedEx. You know, how are you doing today? What's your name? Where are you from? You know, tell me a little bit about yourself. What are you working on? Like, if you lead the conversation, they're going to feel more comfortable. So just recently, UND did an ice cream social for the new freshmen that were on campus because we didn't want to be inside Clifford 210 just because of the COVID protocols. So we did like an ice cream social outside. And it was funny because all the faculty were standing around the outside, and then there was this big pack of new freshmen on the inside and nobody was talking. So I was like, well, screw it. Let's go chat. So I just, you know, walked up to random people, even though I still get nervous, but I'm like, whatever. I'm just like, hey, how are you today? Like, you know, I'm Dan, what's your name? And where are you from? Like, if you always have some basic questions, where are you from? What are you doing up here? Blah, blah, blah. It gets them talking and it kind of opens up conversation. And so I would really encourage you to remember what it's like being in your shoes. How do I help UND students? How do I pave the way? How do I work hard at my current job so that UND looks good, that people want to hire UND alum? Because for every like 10 great UND alum that are out there, there's probably, you know, a bad apple, you know, one dude or dudette lurking out there who, you know, makes us look bad. And so how can I, as a UND alum, help UND to look good? How can I do good at my job, encourage them to hire other UND alum? Hope that answers that question.
No, that totally answers my question. And it's kind of funny when you're talking about like blasting music out to the airport. I remember like all in 325, I always like struggled on flows and other stuff like that. But like, if I just like bumped to like these three certain songs, I was just absolutely fired up for the flight. Yep. Absolutely fired up. It's pretty crazy.
Man. And then you can mentally, you know what you can do? Like, you can actually really take it even further. You can anchor those moments. So you can anchor the moment of like going to 20 inches, right? And you can like think, you can hit the song in your head. And while you're sitting at home, you can actually go 20 inches and have that music cranked and go 20 inches, brakes release, right? And there's that like pump of adrenaline. And so then you can actually, you can anchor that. So then when you actually, when your physical hand goes to 20 inches in the plane, your brain can start to hear that song and you're just like, boom, let's go. You know, like it's time to rock and roll. So, I mean, it's kind of funny how your brain can, you can program your brain with certain physical activities that trigger that memory that gets you excited.
So I know you're talking a little bit about like different companies coming to UND. What do you think about most of these programs that are going through UND right now?
I will say they're insane. And anybody from my generation will tell you they're insane. The opportunities that UND students have today are phenomenal. I mean, there is no other way to say it other than it's phenomenal. Like if, you know, when I was in your shoes, right? I mean, I had no idea if I was ever going to make it to an airline. You had no idea it was going to happen. It was so hard to get a job. You had to just, you know, fight and claw your way to even get like flying like a turboprop at like a cargo company. You know, they used to fly like, they used to fly checks back in the day between the banks. And so like you would fight for that overnight check job flying a 1975, you know, piece of junk twin somewhere. Like we would do anything for flight hours, man. We would do anything. And nowadays, man, you could be like, oh, I'm a UND CFI, and UND will be like, how many flight hours can we give you? Right. I mean, that's the way it is at UND, man. How many students can you handle? That's the way it is. But that is not the way it used to be. I remember one workshop that we did. We had like, it was like 200 applicants for 25 CFI jobs. Jeez. So people back in the day, a lot of guys had to leave and go somewhere else to get hours to come back to UND. So the students today, man, it's awesome. It's insane, but you need to keep it in perspective. Like you do have tremendous opportunities. So even in the worst times, like I know people, I know bad things go on. Like, I think, you know, right now it's been hard for stage checks right now because everything's kind of backed up. And, you know, there's always going to be these little issues, but I'm always like, but take the bigger picture. The bigger picture is you have what? United Airlines coming here saying, here's this program where in like 5 years after graduation, you'll be a major airline pilot. Yeah, exactly. Why it's holding up too, because that happens. That is stupid, man. If you're 25 years old for 40 years making six figures at an airline, you have the opportunity that most people in the world would kill for. So remember that all these little individual problems, and they are problems, you have things that happen and you can't get into a flight lab and your instructor leaves or you have a bad check ride or something like that. Remember the bigger picture. And that is that you guys, it's such an amazing opportunity. You have such a phenomenal opportunities. And these pathway programs are absolutely off the chart amazing opportunities for you guys.
So do you know a little bit about like the Sun Country Bridge program at all?
Yeah. So we talked kind of before we started this interview. You know, I will point out that, you know, I am a first officer for Sun Country. I'm not in the recruiting department. So these only represent kind of my own personal viewpoints, you know, just to be on the record. And I am on probation, you know, my first year. And so while Sun Country is really good and I'm not like worried they're hunting me down, I just point that out that these are my own personal opinions. So the Sun Country Airlines pathway program is relatively new. They had an old one that during COVID sort of got, you know, pushed aside like everything did. And they've reintroduced that thanks to the work of a lot of people there. They've really done a good job to try and make it a little bit more feasible and have a higher success rate. The initial people that came through didn't have a great success rate, which is really unfortunate because if you go to a 121 carrier and you, in essence, you wash out of training. I mean, you hate to say wash out, but that's exactly what happens. You don't pass the training and you're let go from the company. And when that happens in your career, it really, there's no other nice way to say it. It sucks. You know, it's like, it's going to be a hard thing then on your resume and your background. So you try to avoid those types of things. So to Sun Country's credit, they've done a really good job to try and start to change that, to make it more successful for UND. And also they do that bridge program with Mankato. So really what it comes down to is once you meet the restricted ATP minimums, you get to go from UND and you get to go fly for Sun Country Airlines in a Boeing 737. And that is one hell of a jump. And it's one hell of an opportunity. So I always tell people, you know, once again, if I was in your shoes and somebody was like, Dan, if you instruct for a year or two and then you get to go fly a Boeing 737, if I was in your shoes, I would be like, there's no way that could ever happen. But it can. And in fact, it's becoming more the norm, which is amazing. It's just a tremendous opportunity for you guys. Sun Country's basic pathway program really is a way that you basically, instead of going to a regional, you know, you would go right into the 737. Again, I'm just talking some specifics here with Sun Country. I know they've tried to give their pathway program students a look into the training program before they start it. And that's helped out quite a bit. You know, like recently now, regional airlines, when you go to like a SkyWest or an Endeavor or one of these companies, they know where you're at. They know you've never worked for an airline before. You know, what does an airline pilot do? What is their job? What do they wear? How do they act? Professionalism, you know, what kind of bags do you get? Like crew travel, I mean, jump seating. And there's like all of these things that like, call it airline pilot basics 101 that the regional airlines know, and they tell you, they teach you, and then they teach you how to prepare for training, how to get ready for sims, how to do flows. They teach you all this stuff. Sun Country, though, up until recently, they're kind of like, they're used to guys coming from the regionals, you know, to Sun Country. So what was happening is a lot of these younger guys didn't know, you know, how to get ready for the actual like training platform. So now, they're trying to get you glimpses of like, what does it take in the classroom? What does it take in the sim? What does it take in the IPTs? And that way they've had a lot better success recently because I think people are now aware of like what it takes to make it through an airline training program. So that's good news. And again, the opportunity to go from flying a Seminole or an Archer to a 737 and what we do at Sun Country is pretty awesome.
That's pretty insane. So
yeah, I believe they like how they restructured the training. They've had a 100% pass rate since they restructured the training. Just putting that out there.
It's been much better. And Julie is one of our she runs the pilot recruiting, and she's done a phenomenal job of trying to make it a big priority that I say students, but you know, at the time new hires are set up for success. And, you know, we talk about that term a lot in the industry is setting people up for success. And she's just done a phenomenal job to set those people that are transitioning and making that jump up for success. And a big part of that is letting them see what it's going to take and getting them into the system a little bit to see that and get an idea for it so that they come in, you know, with their feet on the ground running rather than drinking from the fire hose on day one. They're kind of a little bit ready for what it's going to take.
That's really good that Sun Country is kind of rolling into that. I know. So I kind of want to go over one last topic before we are done today. And that was interview process. I know you're very involved with UND prepping students for interviews. What kind of got you into that, and what does your interview process look like?
Yeah, you bet. So the interview prep is an interesting thing, and there's so much history there. It's kind of difficult to roll it all into one. But one of the things that I can tell you is historically, going back quite a few years, we had a lot of airlines tell us, man, your students, they're great pilots. They're great people. They suck at interviews. And I mean, there's no polite way to say it. And so back then, a guy named Rocky Graziano, who was a professor at UND, but now I think he's at the General Atomics, but Rocky and I started doing evening like seminars. You know, we would do like just evening interview prep seminars. It was kind of bizarre because there would be like four people that would show up for these things. And I remember Rocky coming up, there was one we did and there was like two people there. And he came up to me and he's like, I'm never doing this again. You know, we don't get paid for that. The UND doesn't pay us anything. I mean, we just did it because like, we just want to help again. Like, you know, it's a passion that we have. It's helping students and helping get people ready. And so we give all of our time and just people didn't even show up. So I didn't blame him at all. And I'm like, I get it, man. And that was the last seminar that we actually did. We were getting this feedback, like your students just don't get interviews. And I understand why, because if you've heard my story about interviews, it goes back to when I bombed an airline interview with Northwest Airlines in 2001. I mean, I bombed it because I didn't know any better. I didn't know any better. And so I kind of made it like my personal mission after that to make sure that everybody I knew, all my friends, my students, I wanted to make sure that they knew what that process was going to be. And so it's kind of like a personal mission for me to make sure that you're ready for the interview. And so, but moving forward then after these seminars and our feedback from the industry, we decided to put interview and career preparation into the capstone class so that every student at least had to be exposed to it, whether or not they took any, you know, advice from it, that's kind of on the student, but at least we're, you know, like the old saying, you take the horse to water, you know, we're bringing the students to the water, but you guys have to drink the water. And so here's kind of a crazy scenario. How much money does somebody spend in 325? You know, like 10, how much money is
10 grand, maybe
10 grand, maybe 15. Right? Probably 10 grand at least. Right. Okay. You spend 10 grand and you get this piece of paper, right? Do you get to go fly an airliner after that?
No,
sir.
No. So, okay. You just spent 10 grand. You worked so hard. You've spent, you know, months going to the airport, studying, doing all this stuff, and you don't even get to go fly an airliner. Now come the interview, the application, that type of stuff. Okay. You're not actually spending any money on that, that company is actually going to spend a bunch of money on you. They're going to have to devote resources, you know, a chief pilot, HR people to interview you. How much preparation are you putting forward towards this interview where if at the end of that interview, they say yes, you get to go fly a jet and get paid for it and do what you've dreamed of forever. And you know what's dumb? People don't do anything. They don't study. They don't whatever. And I'm just like, what are you doing? You just spent 150 grand in 4 years of your life in Grand Forks, North Dakota. And you're not willing to like, here's finally the end. This is like the most important event of your career. And you're not willing to do even more for it. In fact, not only are they not willing to do more for it, they don't do anything for it. They just show up. I'm like, what are you doing? Like, I'm sorry, but if you're that low on the decision-making intelligence, I don't know, man. That's just not wise at all. If you are at the threshold of your dream job and you're not willing to put forth an insane amount of preparatory effort, I just don't get it. I really don't get it. So my advice to people is gobble up whatever interview information you can. So if you're at UND, it's my mission to make sure that every UND student, if they want it, they don't have to drink the water, but I want them to at least see my video course that I give them to now in Capstone, ask questions if you want, learn the basics of Interview Foundation. But man, if it were me and what I do for interviews is I go crazy. Like I have books on interviews. So like my interview at Sun Country, I studied hard for a long time. I got all the possible interview questions I could. I called people that had gone through the interview. I studied, I prepped. I have an old book called Checklist for Success that has a lot of like, you know, really good questions and exercises. And I would go to Panera Bread. I would drop my daughter off and I'd go over there for like an hour and I would study while she was at practice. I would study for that interview over and over and over again. And some people were like, why are you doing that? Why are you working so hard? And I'm like, because I get to go fly a 737. Like it's what I want. If that's the target that I want, why would I not put everything I got into getting that job? And here's the deal. I'm telling you, if you're not willing to put everything you got into that, then I know when you get to this job, you're not going to put everything you got into this job. So I, you know, people that have these like Delta, the Delta programs, the United programs, the FedEx programs, you have these unbelievable opportunities. Sun Country, go fly a 737 at 1,000 hours. You have this incredible opportunity before you. I would do everything you can to get the job. I use a service, like there's some UND alums out there that run a service, you know, airlinepilotcareers.com. They started using my videos now in conjunction with their preparatory service. But like, man, historically, there's all these other companies. Emerald Coast is a very famous consulting company that is in aviation. But I'm telling you, like all these companies, you might have to pay like $300-$400 or $500 to like get practice interviews with them, they'll review your application. They'll do all this stuff to help you prepare. And I'm like, you would spend $500 on one flight lesson at UND that got you nothing in, I'm just being facetious, right? Nothing in return. You're obviously, you know, you're working towards your goal. But at the end of that flight lesson, you get a debrief from your instructor and that's it. Whereas if you get offered a job at like Delta Airlines, why would you not invest $500? If somebody told me, Dan, if you invest $10,000 and 3 months of hard studying and working and, you know, hard everything, but at the end, you have a really good shot at getting this dream job, I would do it in a heartbeat. So I just don't really understand why people get to the edge of like success. Like they get to the edge of their dream job and they just make bad decisions. They don't study. They don't work hard. They don't do what they should be doing. They don't, you know, read and study interview questions. They don't do anything really. And they just show up. And I'm like, man, this is where you should be working the hardest. And they don't, you know. Actually, Alex from Airline Pilot Careers, he gives a great presentation on the monetary effects of not getting hired at a major. So like, let's say you get an interview with United Airlines, right? He will show you if you don't get that job and you stay at like a regional airline, he'll show you the monetary difference of how many millions and millions of dollars you will lose out on, not to mention the career and the job, but the millions and millions of dollars that you just walked away from because you didn't put forth the effort to get ready for the job. So it's so important. And I just, you know, we can say it over and over again, but man, to circle back and make a full circle with what you talked about with these pathway programs, the Sun Country, the Delta, the United Aviate, all these programs, it is so worth your time. And if you want to do private consulting or buy books or buy programs, it is so worth your money because at the end of that prep, you hopefully have, you know, the job of a lifetime.
That's great.
Yeah, it's super good advice. I have two things really, really quick. We were in Capstone in last Tuesday and or Thursday, and Sun Country was up here introducing their bridge program. And we watched one of your videos and you said, never, ever go to a job interview without your shoes being shined. So after that, me and Alex went to Target, found some shined up our shoes. I mean, I couldn't believe how much of a difference it made. I mean, my shoes are fantastic now.
It does. And it's easy. It's easy.
Yeah. It's surprisingly, it was like $5 for like a little thing. Everyone should do it.
I agree.
And then the last thing, I know you do have those videos available online. How could people access those videos if they aren't in Capstone right now?
Yeah, so this is about a year ago now. They used to be online. I paid a lot of money. They're professionally done. They're studio driven, and I paid a lot of money to host those videos. Let's just say that. And for a long time they were just free and out there. After a long time of people like not even knowing they were there, not using them, and frustration after frustration after frustration, and after people telling me for years and years and years, they're like, well, you should probably charge for those. There was actually one incident last year that I just kind of had it with people not using those videos. So I was like, you know what? If people want them, you know, then I'll just charge a fee that can help me pay for the support. Like I pay $400 a month to host online courses and the videos and things like that. So I finally was like, I'm going to switch them to a paid service. So there's two ways that people can do that. Number one, I do partner with the guys at Airline Pilot Careers. So if you know them, they're UND alum. They've been in hiring boards at the regionals. They are very, very good at preparing you for any interview. So I of course highly recommend them, but in full disclosure, they use those videos. So if you work with them, they will use those videos to help you get started. And then they'll actually start doing like individual consulting and targeted consulting towards the interviews for that company that you're going for, application reviews. But those videos are used as part of that. You can, if you want just the videos and some interview questions, just danmalott.com, danmalott.com. You can just buy the video course. I think it's $99 to use the videos. But In a single month, I have never gotten more money than I've spent to host the course. So I don't do that to try to make money. I'm just trying to offset the cost a little bit. But in Capstone, as you mentioned, you get those for free. I'm always willing to help UND students for free. And in fact, most of these companies will help you for free. You just have to know, like, my videos, like to have a studio make those and do those well and then host them and then have a course that tracks them, that's not cheap. And so I always like to stress that I'm not making money on those. I just try to offset the cost. So that's why they're a paid service, and you can get them either from me or through the guys at airlinepilotcareers.com.
Sweet. Awesome. Well, that's one way to go get it then. Well, Dan, I think we're up on our time now. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast. We're very, very excited to have you on.
Anytime. I appreciate you guys having me on. I'm sorry that I talked too much, but happy to talk about anything anymore. And just let me know. But again, thanks. And I wish everybody that's listening the best of luck.
All right. Thanks, Dan.
Thanks for listening, guys. Hope you enjoyed the podcast.
If you have any questions for us, DM us on Instagram @vertical_guidance.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks.